On this week's 51%, we hear from a photographer who takes on societal sneers at body image.
I don't want it to be just about a blonde girl that's overweight who chooses not to wear designer clothes and makeup. But it's really about our image and time and how it ties into our identity.
And we explore the biography of one of the most important French writers of the 20th century. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Becoming an internet sensation was the last thing on photographer Haley Morris Caffiero's mind when she released a series of self-portraits on LensScratch, a fine art site frequented mostly by photography aficionados. The images showed an overweight woman in public places being met with ridicule, gawks, and sneers. When the Huffington Post and the Daily Mail picked up the series, viewers deluged the sites, expressing both condemnation and praise. She was called everything from a fat lump of lard who should kick her donut habit to brilliant and so powerful. The photos hit a cultural nerve, speaking to our standards of female form and beauty, the expectations placed on women to achieve them, and societal reaction when such standards are tossed aside. The experience inspired Morris Caffiero to expand her series of self-portraits, and camera in hand, she hit the road, surreptitiously having photos snapped of herself in destinations such as Prague and Miami. The result is her book, The Watchers. I asked her how it all started. She said about 6 years ago in New York City in Times Square.
Yeah, the project started about almost 6 years ago when I was shooting an earlier project where it was just about self-portraits about me in different spaces and didn't have anything to do with the public or other people. And I set up one in Times Square on the Coca-Cola steps. And I didn't know, so about 2 or 3 weeks later when I got the film back, and noticed that behind me there was someone looks like he's sneering at me. And I remember seeing that couple there, but I don't, you know, that was it. And then it happened 5 minutes later, the same roll of film in a different location. And so I thought, well, I don't know what these people are thinking, but what happens if you set up a camera in public and document just as people walk by me? And so I traveled all over the world to try to get a diverse pool of people as possible. I don't want it to be about one gender or any specific demographic. And I pull the images that appear to have someone who is critical or questioning of me in some way.
Haley, I wanted to just ask you procedurally, when I understand self-portrait, but so are you setting up a camera to go off timing taking you, or is there a human being taking pictures of you?
Most of the time, it's a human being. I set up the exposure, I set everything up. All the camera settings are set, and they're not even looking in the camera, and I just give them a signal, like I'll, you know, shake my hand or twist my hair. And then they'll just push the shutter release button. They're just basically a human tripod. And, you know, I just have to be clear that I do not know what these people are thinking or reacting to, even if it's me. It's just about that moment in time that I've captured. And I haven't edited it. It's nothing constructed. It's just presented to start the conversation about how we look at one another.
I did look through all the photos that are on your website. And, you know, you also mention in some of the text there, your goal is to reverse the gaze. Have you started to accomplish that? Do you see that happening?
I do. Because to me, it's equally valid, the conversation of people saying, you know, from my point of view, they're not looking at you is equally valid as someone saying, oh, my God, how dare they? Because that's what it's about. It's about we reverse the gaze, we show what's happening, and then we look and see, you know, how that's perceived, because throughout this, you know, I guess the project was first published online in February of 2013. There, I've received hundreds of emails from people that talk about how when someone looks at them like that, it's worse than a knife. Like some people really hurt when someone is looking at them. Like, you know, they'll alter the way they think about themselves based on how they think someone looks at them. It's a very powerful tool, but it can also be a weapon, and it's not even in our control what that role is. It's so interesting because it's how the person being viewed interprets it.
How do you interpret it? What is your interpretation? And after, you know, you talked about Times Square and then 5 minutes later on that role, you see another and you start to see these looks. I mean, how do you feel?
I mean, I think it's a very scientific explanation, but I'm just thrilled that something that happens in such a microsecond moment was captured. It's a social experiment in my eyes. Now, once the images were published on the internet, and then people started making comments about me, which is what is featured in the book. It's the images and then the comments, the positive and negative comments that I've received either on websites or through emails are published with the images in the book. So like one of them is like, her body looks like a pillowcase full of doorknobs. And there's a blog dedicated to how ugly I am. And to me, that is hilarious, like, because people will take the time out of, they'll take electricity, they'll take effort to post comments and to send me emails about how I look like I got off the short bus when I don't care what they think. So that's kind of when we published the book, that's what was really important to bring in to the narrative, was that this entire, you know, the gaze, you know, its cause or its meaning is questionable. And I love the discussion that happened, but there's also things that aren't questionable, that people are bullies online and that people find great inspiration in certain things. Like I've had people email me that they were going to kill themselves and they saw my images and didn't. And so that impact is, you know, to me a lot more emotional than the ones in the photographs.
And so, you know, you continue being interested, obviously, in how society uses its gazes. And, you know, when you look at these, like you say, it's a moment in time. I get that, whether it's a sneer or critic, however we want to categorize it, or you want to categorize it, or I, looking at the photo, choose to categorize it. And that could be different than your choice in categorizing that look.
Right. Exactly.
Right. But in all, I mean, it's clear they're looking at something that, you know, there's just this reaction. Is it projecting emotion? And, you know, I think you even mentioned that, how we use gazes to project emotions. And, you know, what are you taking away from that?
I'm taking away the discussion. I know that sounds really, it sounds really clinical because I mean, I love myself. I love the way I look. When I see someone, whether, no matter how they're looking at me, I don't self-analyze because I don't need to. So I think that's why, I mean, you know, besides the fact that it is, you know, an experiment and I don't know what they're thinking when I look at them, it doesn't motivate me in any way against myself because I am fine with myself.
Hallie, so talk about the book, The Watchers. So,
you know, The Watchers is a book that takes about 60 years of images from the Weight Watchers series and puts them in a kind of an organization so that there's some times where you see multiple images from the shoot, kind of the before and after. And there's also new images that have never been published and comments. Like the entire cover is covered in positive comments on the front and negative comments on the back. And it's squishy. And you know, so you're actually like feeling like a squishy object while you're reading it. And throughout the narrative are these negative comments right next to positive comments, like someone trying to tear me down and someone who was raised up by the experience. And so like that holistic view is presented in the book. And that was really important because we wanted to give the images a presentation in a way that would not be on the internet. You know, in the internet, you see the image and you move on. But this, there's comments, there's multiple images, and just the feel of the book that presents the images in an entirely new way.
Because we're on the radio and we don't have the images in front of us, I would like you to explain. I mean, people might think, well, why, who cares? What, you know, why are people looking at Hallie like this? So maybe you could explain more about body image and fat shaming.
I'll give you an example by talking about one of the images, if that's okay.
Sure.
For instance, you know, I went on all these trips with a group of students. And when we got to Barcelona, the second our little group walked out, of our hotel, it was immediately evident that people were just looking at one another, just like everyone was looking each other down and up and down. And I thought, okay, this looks like a potential. And when I was, we were going to a museum and we were standing at a crosswalk, and it was one of those days that felt like 115 degrees. And one of my students was, you know, was very, very petite, you know, had her shirt tied up like a halter, and she was wearing shorts. And we were standing at a crosswalk, and in the reflection in front of us, I saw two men behind us who were, one of them was doing their hands in the shape of an hourglass behind her and in shape of a ball around me. And they were saying, calling me Gorda, which is fat. So I said, okay, let me set up a camera at a crosswalk. And a few minutes later, I got some ice cream and I stood at the crosswalk with the camera across the way. And when I started eating the ice cream, I immediately, the light changed and people started gathering. And I immediately heard this girl, or heard this kind of pat, and it was a girl next to me hitting her stomach. And it was just repeating over and over and over again, that just sound. And no matter what the image looked like, just the visual of a hand hitting an abdomen most likely would be a successful image in terms of what I'm talking about. You know, like I didn't even have to see the girl. I just saw her out of my periphery and heard the tapping and the patting. Anyway, I signaled to my assistant and that image became gelato. And that's one of the kind of iconic images. And, you know, I could have turned around and said something to those men. I could have turned around and, because they didn't clearly understand that I knew Spanish. So I could have turned around and told them off, but I just thought, you know, that would, if anything, add to their, I don't know. I think I wanted more something like my effort to go towards something that would last longer than a 20-minute or a 20-second little conversation. For me, it's about being, you know, overweight, but it's also about being blonde. It's also about being a woman. It's also about wearing just comfortable clothes. So it's really about being an other in society.
What is success for you then in terms of putting out this book? What would you like to accomplish?
You know, I just want to inspire somebody to like feel better about themselves. Everybody is fine the way they are. You can only control what you do for yourself. And hopefully, you know, that inspires people.
Do you think this goes across a gender line? I mean, you mentioned, you know, being a woman, being blonde. It's not just being what people consider overweight. If this were a man doing the same project, would this work?
You know, I think it would. You know, this project has had a huge impact on transgender population and huge. And I never, again, this is, I'm a little artist that's just making this for my artistic work. But the impact, I think, and particularly a lot of men have reacted to that. And they said that they have seen, that they have received looks, and that they have, I know several transgender or gender fluid people who have been physically attacked for the way that they look, like physically attacked. And I think the idea of the gaze and our interpretation of our identity based on how we look, it impacts everyone across all genders, across all ages. And several times I get emails from people who, you know, couldn't come out or you know, because of whatever situation that they were in. And on top of that, they're being bullied, just normal, quote unquote, bullying. And then on top of that, there are questions with that they're having about themselves. And I think it's been, the project's been very accepted. And in fact, I've been invited to study at to speak at a LGBTQ program. And I think that's really wonderful, because I don't want it to be just about a blonde girl that's overweight who chooses not to wear designer clothes and makeup. But it's really about, you know, our image and time and how it ties into our identity.
Haley, I'd like to know what you think about fat shaming.
I think people have believe that they are truly helping overweight people by telling them that they're going to die, and that they're telling them that they're going to die, and that I'm going to have diabetes, or, you know, the blog is dedicated to me how ugly I am is also dedicated that if I put the camera down and just took that time to exercise, then I would be okay. And, you know, how dare I use all of our welfare, and I'm jobless, and I have diabetes, and it's all these things that you can't look at somebody and identify any of these things. But even if you could, it's not your job to fix it. I don't care what they think. I don't care. I love my husband dearly. I don't care what he thinks. I mean, I'm going to wear what I'm going to wear. I'm going to look how I'm going to look. I go to the doctor regularly. Thank you. It's, you know, so easy just to let someone live their life, and it's up to the doctor to impress upon them medical issues. And otherwise, just, you don't know the shoes that they walk in. You don't know their life. You don't know that I don't eat most fattening things and walk around all the time, but that's okay. It's not your job.
Of all the photos so far, what one do you go back to, or maybe look at, you know, more than others, or that just stands out to you?
There's one of the new ones called Sunscreen, which is me on a beach in a bathing suit. And I think that one, because, you know, I'm standing there in my swimsuit, and there's teenagers who are, you know, in their bikinis. And I think that that whole idea of when we put ourselves in situations, even if you're thin and confident, like, you always put yourself in situations where, even if you don't feel vulnerable, you are expected to feel vulnerable. So even if I have no problems with my body, it enters my mind because society tells me that I should be worried about going to the beach. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it every day on the commercials, there's constant, like, get this beach body. And even if you don't agree with it, and if you don't believe in it, at some point it subconsciously creeps in. So I think that one, the ones, you know, particularly of me in a swimsuit, are that kind of impact for me. Because I truly just didn't even care. Like, I just went to the beach to go to the beach. And I went to the most vainest cities in the United States, Googled it, and that was LA and Miami Beach. And so I started there.
I mean, there's a lot, as you pointed out, and, you know, there's a lot of very positive comments, and there are a lot of very negative comments. Do mm-hmm. any of these comments hurt you?
No.
You've not been hurt once by any of this?
No, I mean, I'm sad for the status of the world. But other than that, no. Like, it makes me laugh. I mean, it makes me laugh because it's insane that someone would say that. I mean, there's people who've emailed me from their professional email account with their name and their number and their email, I mean, like, address and everything, who are telling me how ugly I am. Like, and I'm just thinking, like, what makes you think I care? Like, what makes you think I care about what you, of all people, you're an ant on the anthill of the galaxy. Like, what do I care about what you think? And I think it's funny. And then I go shoot more and I come up with new projects. So, I mean, I think if everybody felt as I did, then they would be silenced, but obviously they don't. They want me to be quiet. They want me to be sad. They want me to question myself. They want me to criticize myself. And it's never going to happen.
That was Haley Morris Caffiero, photographer and performance artist, whose book is called The Watchers. She is an associate professor and assistant dean at Memphis College of Art in Tennessee. New guidance issued by a New York City agency includes a provision saying that pregnant women cannot be kept out of bars or refused alcoholic drinks just because they're expecting. The City Human Rights Commission guidelines outline a variety of anti-discrimination measures and expound on a 2013 city law that mostly concerns protections for pregnant workers. Included is a warning saying bouncers cannot refuse to let mothers-to-be into bars and that restaurants cannot refuse to serve them alcohol. The U.S. Surgeon General and major medical associations say pregnant women should avoid alcohol. New York City itself requires restaurants to post warnings that alcohol can cause birth defects. Nevertheless, city officials say such health concerns are up to the woman, not a bartender. And now, Caitlin Esch explores the biography of one of the most important French writers of the 20th century.
Simone de Beauvoir was born in 1908 to an upper-middle-class family, but that privilege largely dissipated after her grandfather went bankrupt. Beauvoir's father was determined that both she and her sister would get an education and become self-supporting.
And this was quite distinct, obviously, when compared to other bourgeois upbringings.
Bradley Stevens from the University of Bristol is an expert in French literature and history.
Women were expected to marry, to make a good marriage, and to go on and become good wives and mothers. Simone de Beauvoir, of course, didn't follow this path.
Beauvoir was one of the first women to get a degree from the Sorbonne. Later, as a young woman in the 1930s, she taught philosophy. And then in 1939, World War II hits Europe like a hammer. The Nazis occupy France.
More than three-fifths of their country was to be blacked out by a military occupation. The remainder was to be controlled by a French government acceptable to Hitler. A tax of 400 million francs a day was to be imposed on the French people to support the German army of occupation.
The war years are hard on Beauvoir, both personally and materially. Her apartment is so cold that she writes from cafes. Oh, and of course, the war separates Beauvoir from her lifelong companion, Jean-Paul Sartre, and her lover, Jacques-Laurent Bost. Both go off with the army.
And this separation from two very important men in her life left her at once vulnerable, but also acutely aware of her own independence and her own ideas.
Around this time, Beauvoir also begins an ill-fated love affair with a female ex-student that ends up bringing down her teaching career.
It's very easy with Simone de Beauvoir for us to focus on what has, over the years, been revealed to be an increasingly colourful personal life, her intimate relationships with both men and women.
But of course, Simone de Beauvoir should not simply be defined by her unconventional romantic liaisons.
Because she had a very rich social network that she helped shape and generate during this period. She was great friends, for example, with the artist Giacometti, and also with Cocteau. This very mythic, very irresistible image of a generation of great creativity.
Through it all, Beauvoir and Sartre were incredibly close. They weren't just partners. They read together, traveled together, and according to Beauvoir's autobiography, there was only one night in their decades-long relationship where they even disagreed. While Sartre was an existentialist philosopher, Beauvoir saw herself more as a writer.
This mantle of philosopher is one that comes loaded with a certain cultural capital, this image of a patriarchal male white class.
Beauvoir wrote novels and autobiographies so her thoughts would be more accessible to women of all classes. And then her book, The Second Sex, comes out. It's instantly popular and considered very scandalous.
Être femme, ce n'est pas une donnée naturelle.
Being a woman is not a natural fact. It's the result of a certain history. There's no biological or physiological or psychological destiny that defines a woman as such. She's the product of history, civilization, first of all, which has resulted in her current status.
Beauvoir's assertion that women can reclaim their social privilege and power and be equal to men rightly threatens the patriarchy.
And so you have Albert Camus saying to her in private, this essay makes French men look weak. You've got François Mauriac, the famous novelist, saying that this essay is borderline pornography. But the book sells 20,000 copies in the first week.
The Second Sex raised eyebrows, but it also cemented Simone de Beauvoir's status as a feminist philosopher. Beauvoir died in 1986. Her funeral was held 6 years to the day after Sartre's, and she was buried alongside him in Paris. Bradley Stevens says whenever he visits Beauvoir's grave, he sees flowers, metro tickets, cigarettes, and letters.
It's borderline mythic, and she would always warn us against the temptation to mythologize and idealize somebody's life or their reputation. Nonetheless, I think it's undeniable to say that Simone de Beauvoir is certainly one of the most important French writers of the 20th century. She is undeniably one of its great women.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. Percent is spelled out. This week's show is number 1402.